You're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, this is the Food Talk Radio Show, and each week we taste innovative, new and interesting food or drink, and we take a look at the latest food tech advances from across the UK. Hello everyone, my name is Sue Nelson and I'm joined by the wonderful Guy Routledge, co-founder of Food Rush. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Sue. It's a pleasure to be back in the studio again on this lovely sunny day, although we're now in a dark room.
So it doesn't matter, does it?
It doesn't really matter. It could be raining for all I care.
I couldn't be more excited about the programme today.
We've got a good show today, haven't we?
We've got so much to talk about. We've got so much to fit in. It's amazing. But before we do that, is there anything in the news that's caught your eye this week?
Anything in the news? So I've been very busy for the last week or so, and I have not been keeping up with the news as I should. But I was going back through the backlog, so I used this app to aggregate various different bits and pieces of interesting information that I can come back to later whenever I find the time. And I came across something from a couple of weeks ago, which was all about wine. And surprisingly, that caught my eye because, you know, I like a good drink.
And it's one of my favourite
subjects. One of your favourite things as well. So here's a question for you, Sue. Red or white? What do you choose?
Summer's day, white, definitely nice and chilled. But if I'm having pasta or something meaty, it's got to be red.
Yeah, I'd be inclined to agree with you. How about blue wine?
No, I don't think so.
Sounds a bit strange, doesn't it? A little bit strange, maybe a little bit innovative. Well, I was reading a story the other day. It was on the New York Times. And a wine producer in Spain, in the Basque region, I believe it was, they have been producing a blue wine, and they had some kind of additives to it. And
is it natural colouring, or is it just something they've conjured up?
I can't remember the specifics, to be brutally honest with you, but it's some kind of additive, whether it's natural or unnatural, I'm not sure. I don't think it's food colouring, but it's something that changes the kind of the chemical makeup of the wine and makes it look completely different. But they were slapped with a fine because they were saying blue wine all over the label.
Slapped with a fine?
Yeah, the Ministry for Agriculture said they violated wine regulations over there, and so they've had to change remove things, change it, and make it look slightly less blue.
Probably because it feels a bit Frankenstein-y, maybe.
Yeah, it's very strange. I mean, I don't know how we're going to embrace food innovation if all the innovators are being slapped on the wrist and saying no, you can't do that.
Tut tut tut
indeed.
Well, I'd like to introduce you, Guy, to Melanie Goldsmith. Now, I've tasted Melanie Goldsmith's products, Smith & Sinclair.
They're amazing.
God, fantastic. And I was really, really worried that Melanie was going to come into the studio and not bring some samples, but thank God she has. I'm also joined by Ollie Lloyd. And Ollie is from Great British Chefs, and we'll be talking loads and loads about some amazing research he's done and what British Chefs is about. So welcome, Ollie.
Thank you.
First, over to Melanie, though. Melanie, do you want to just describe your product?
Sure. So
what it looks like, what it tastes like,
what it feels like, who you're going on a date with.
Yeah.
So we've got a range of 8 edible cocktails, we call them. They are a twist on a pâte de fruits, so a sort of larger fruit pastel, but they're not chewy like the ones Rowntree's do. They're not that sort of break your teeth pastel.
Are they like, I'm much older than you, but we always used to have like a pack of jellies for Christmas.
It's really, a York
very fruit. Juicy. Yeah, that's it. That's it. York fruit.
Yeah.
Like that.
It's like a modern interpretation of that. So it's halfway between a York fruit and a Haribo, in essence.
But for adults.
But for adults only. So each pastel is deconstructed like a liquid cocktail. So we've got our spirit base, our mixers, bitters, and then we infuse the garnish into the sugar coating. So we've got everything from a thyme-infused sugar to a grapefruit pith-infused sugar for the whiskey sour. And each one is around half a shot, but there's no liquid in the middle. Chewy throughout.
What I'm more amazed with, the deliciousness of sounding of a fruit pastel effectively full of booze, or the really clever way that you've infused all these things into all these sugars and stuff like that. I think we'll probably have to talk about both.
We had some in the office a good few months back, and I couldn't believe I felt a little bit tiddly afterwards because I
did eat
quite
the whole box.
You do.
I ate a few.
Well, 5 and you can't drive.
Yeah. So yeah. Look, Ollie's laughing his head off it. Like, you eat 5 of those, Ollie, you can't drive home.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Only 5.
Okay. Yeah, they do get you. Obviously,
yeah, they do. I'm sure.
Especially as they're pretty Moorish.
Yeah, they're delicious.
So let me describe the packaging to you. It's a difficult thing to sell, actually, because it's difficult to get on the packet what actually is in here because it's so different. It's Smith & Sinclair, and it says, cocktail pastels, premium top shelf. Please eat responsibly. I have to say that because it was alcohol 6% volume. And they've opened up, they're a lovely, lovely packet. Very classy, I would say.
Thank
you. Very classy. And then when you open up, they look like your auntie's pastels that you get at Christmas.
Like a giant fruit pastel.
Yeah, and I'd say they're the size of about, I don't know, what would you say? Size of a...
50p.
Yeah, just slightly larger than 50p.
But nice and plump and fruity and covered in sugar. Are they covered in sugar?
They are, yeah.
Mm. Can you tell me what I've got in front of me? I've got six in this. Is this the normal standard box?
So that was our first mix selection. So that's got whiskey, rum and gin. You have six different cocktails.
Look at Ollie, he's getting so excited here, yeah.
Should we tell them what time it is?
Oh, no.
too early, isn't it?
No, it's not 7 o'clock in the morning. It's fine. It's after lunch. It's fine. So we've got three. So can I open them?
Yeah, please do.
Good.
Russell.
So in this, we've got gin and tonic, whiskey sour, berry, daiquiri, a sprinkling, don't I?
It's an elderflower with thyme gin.
Gin. Mm. Cake icing.
Twist on a godfather, so it's whiskey amaretto.
And spiced rum. I can't stop myself from laughing.
You're getting excited.
Spiced rum.
Self-explanatory.
Self-explanatory. So can you tell me why you set this up? Because actually us three want to start eating and it gives us a chance and we can't talk.
I'll do the talking.
Yes. So explain to me why how on earth you started this, really, while we tuck in. Before we do, Ollie, any preference here? Gin and tonic, rum, whiskey sour?
Whiskey sour.
Kind of, over there?
I'll have whatever's left over. They're all fantastic.
Right, please do.
Maybe we should
off.
Open it before she starts talking, otherwise we won't be able to hear a word.
No, it'll be fine. Please go ahead, Melanie, and tell us what you're up to while we have a little sample.
Sure. So I grew up as a natural sweet fiend. I was that kid that was allowed sweets sort of whenever I wanted, so I had many a cavity. And when I grew up and I started working, I ran a dating night on the side that was all about adult play because I felt there was a real sort of disconnect between what dating nights were trying to encourage, which is interaction and touching and playfulness and getting to know each other, and what dating nights were facilitating were these sorts of very inhibited situations that were very socially awkward. And for the dating nights, to ensure they weren't socially awkward, we created sort of an adult candy bar, in essence.
A candy bar as in like a bar where you go to get drinks rather than a candy bar, like a chocolate bar?
No, like a cocktail bar. Mm-hmm. But because we didn't want people to get on the floor and be spilling the drinks everywhere, we made sure that the drinks were edible.
Fantastic. And I guess it saves you having to wait up in line as well.
Yeah, and you don't need to pee as much.
Well, we've jumped right in, haven't we, today?
Straight to the point. Ollie, they smell alcoholic. I mean, you open the packet and you go, wow, can't mistake the fact they're alcoholic. Well, I'm not actually sure you did get the whiskey sour one there. I think you might have got the cake icing one, but what thoughts?
Delicious. I mean, the texture's really sort of dense.
Very, but it's still kind of jelly and squishy. And
Do
you think you're supposed to eat them in one, or do you think you're supposed to nibble?
No,
them?
We sort of, well, we say 2 to 3 bites. Okay. Because in one, you've got quite a mouthful, but also... because the flavours develop as you eat it, it's not like a chocolate liqueur which sort of bursts in your mouth and then you can't taste anything else. It's not, it's supposed to develop. So if you eat it in one, you don't get all the flavours you wouldn't down a cocktail.
And the nice thing is, although they've got the sort of sugar coating on the outside a little bit, these really aren't sweet, are they?
No, not overly sweet.
I don't like sweet, and these are really, really nice. What's your favourite, Melanie? It means I can have another bite.
Depends on the day. It's kind of like you with wine. It's, you know, I like the berry daiquiris. Been my number one since day one. But then we recently launched a vodka selection and we've got a rhubarb infused Moscow Mule. So it's with ginger, lime and a rhubarb base.
Have you brought any of those with you?
I've got a second pack in the bag. Yeah.
Oh God, excellent.
Today's going to be a write-off. But the best kind.
You're not driving home, are you?
No, I'm not. The rhubarb one sounds amazing. How did you manage to get the very, very juicy? So they're not dry at all, are they? They're not horrible... like you say, round tree pastel thing, where those are hard, aren't they? They are really, really juicy. That's gone to my head already, really. I haven't really eaten anything today.
So professional. So,
I am very professional. But what I really like is you've got that sort of very juicy, moist thing in the middle. And around the outside, there's quite a bit of texture. The smell is alcoholic. really.
It's wonderful. I think what you were trying to ask was how you get the booze into the pastel and still make and have that texture. Because it sounds really simple, right? An alcoholic fruit pastel, two things that people understand, but I'm sure it's quite complicated from a product development point of view.
Mm. Well, it's funny because people assume we either inject it, that we inject alcohol into it, which obviously wouldn't set. And other people think we just soak a normal pastel in alcohol until it absorbs it and then coat it in sugar, which wouldn't work.
No.
It is hard. My business partner, Emil, is the genius behind the development of it. And no one has managed to do exactly what we've done, which is why we have a patent on the product.
Fantastic.
But it's more, you know, to make alcoholic jelly, like everyone has tried vodka jelly in their life and everyone's tried to make it. But to have that set at ambient temperature for a long time is what the tricky part is, because alcohol reacts to sugar. It creates that inversion, which gives it like a syrupy kind of outer coating. And obviously ours stay dry.
Because these aren't chilled. It's not like you have to get them from the fridge aisle in the supermarket.
It's the ambient thing that's difficult. Yeah, exactly. Isn't it? It's very difficult. And you've got no artificial colours or preservatives. No. And that is very hard, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we use, at the moment, juice the grapefruit, infuse the grapefruit in the whiskey sour with our own juice, and we dehydrate the pith ourselves. Like, we don't bring in any sort of artificially dried, you know, that freeze-dried products or anything like that even, because it gives it a funny texture. So the consistency is best when it's all with natural products.
Can I ask you to open another packet?
You've only had one so far.
No, I want to try these other. Do you mind?
I'm going to go for this dark red one here. It looks good.
I want to just try some of the other tastes, because that I've just got a really big hit of thyme actually on this, which is really nice. So this one is this is all a pink. This is like pinky sort of packaging. And so in here, these boys are having a great time and smiling away. In here, we've got a Ruby Mule, which is what you described, and Long Island High Tea. Mm. So what's in the Ruby Mule? Is that one?
That's the Ruby Mule.
This is the orange. They look so innocuous. They look like a kid's pastel. I mean, it's frightening,
they
really.
They really do.
It's frightening, isn't it?
There's the warning on the page.
They're the most dangerous thing I've ever eaten. Definitely. So, a Ruby Mule's got...
So that's with a vodka base with ginger, rhubarb, and then the coating is sour lime.
Wow. Right. Guy, ask a question.
Sorry, I've got a mouthful of sweet.
I'll tell you one thing I was worried about was, you know, those sort of old-fashioned sweets, occasionally had sort of the liquid centres.
Mm-mm.
It's really, I was really worried that there was going to be sort of liquid in the centre. Mm. It's nice that actually it's a really consistent...
What, like a liqueur chocolate?
Yeah, that sort of, awful. Mm. Really, you know.
Yeah, we very much want to de-associate ourselves with a chocolate liqueur because they taste rank a lot of the time, but also the very low alcohol volume and very high in alcohol taste because they've got sort of gritty ethanol in it. Whereas our product does have 6-8% ABV. They are half a shot, but the point is that you can enjoy it without it spilling all over you, without it being sticky. And it's supposed to be nostalgic of what you had as pick and mix as a kid. So, you it's know, fantastic. There are very few products we as adults engage with and go, that was a memory association.
It is a bit, but it's and, like a weird one, because it's like a grown-up
version of it. Yeah,
it's fantastic.
So what? How are people consuming these? What are they buying them for?
Predominantly gifts.
Right.
It very much is sort of when you're going to a dinner party, and when you are a foodie who goes to a dinner party, you don't want to just bring a bottle of wine or a box of chocolates. You know, you're always looking for something, you know, like jalapeno and fused cheese and things like this. You know, you're looking for something that's going to be fun to talk about. That's an icebreaker. So, you know, a lot of dinner parties, a lot of people who are, you know, gin drinkers, cocktail drinkers, you're not going to necessarily buy them a bottle of gin for their birthday because you're sort of making them into an alcoholic and spending 40 quid on a bottle of gin. So for that like person who just loves gin, you know, the gin pastels
and it's a bit of a novelty, isn't it, as well?
Yeah, we try not to say novelty because novelties often are poor quality.
Something a bit different.
The quality of these
is
so high.
Different. Mm. And it's something that people do. We get a lot of repeat purchasing from customers who know this is a gift that they can give to a lot of people.
Having trouble concentrating now. I don't know about you, Guy, but
it's so good. I mean, the flavors that we've been tasting, they're really interesting as well. It's not just, you know, your typical, you know, fruit with a bit of booze in it. And something else that I discovered, I was on your website earlier today, and you have this on your about page. You've got all these recipes which are also equally interesting and fascinating. So I just kind of list off a couple of them here. We've got the Captain's Mince Pie Freak Shake cocktail recipe.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the Johnny Walker wrapped in a blanket cocktail recipe. Sprouting Gordon's Gin Fizz, which is like a looks like a gin fizz with a Brussels sprout in it, and a Bloody Mary with all the trimmings.
Mm.
And how did you come up with all of these things? But you know, both the recipes that we see here and the flavors for these. What inspires these kind of things?
Well, we do. So that project was actually in conjunction with Diageo.
Ah.
So they brought us on to develop these sort of hybrid drinks that involved an eating element to them for the Christmas party. And
fantastic.
So that's what those recipes were based on. We're working on another whole cocktail range for a new theatre show that launches at the Vaults in a couple of weeks, which is Alice's Adventures Underground. Mm. And we're doing a whole series of sort of Alice-inspired cocktails that are there to sort of amaze. And
like the Mad Hatter's Tea cocktail and stuff like that.
The Mad Hatter's Tea cocktail, which potentially could change colour.
Oh, wow.
And things like that.
Have you got any of those with you? Just
it's very geared towards experiential. You can see that's suiting a type of, you know, sort of brands who are trying to go into experiential events and stuff like that. I can see that fitting really, really beautifully.
Yeah.
I absolutely love them. So moving on, because I'm trying to concentrate now and I'm struggling with that. In terms of marketing, it is quite a difficult thing to market, because what you're trying to do is try and explain how sophisticated they are. It's quite difficult, because it is completely new. They're not, you can't put them in an aisle with other pastels, because that doesn't work. Can't put them in the drink section. It's actually quite a difficult thing to market, isn't it? And I know that once you started marketing, actually you got an order almost straight away of 20,000. So just explain, I know that's your background, sort of more business background. Have you got any tips or advice for somebody who's, you know, sort of developing something that's that different? What have you learned?
Well, I wasn't trained traditionally as a business woman. I didn't go into a business degree, and I'm not an accountant by any means. So I came from a creative background. Mm. And when we came up with a product, it was a byproduct of an event. We didn't sit down and write a business plan of how to launch the world's first edible cocktail. It came out of games and play and a need for experiences to drive social situations. Mm. Social lubrication, basically.
We all need a bit of that.
Yeah. So when we came to marketing it wasn't ever going to be traditional either. We circumstantially were very lucky that when we were on our market for 3 weeks, and that's the main market we've ever done, the marketing director for Imbibe Live, which is a huge alcohol trade show, had seen the product and got in touch a couple of days after the website launched, and they ordered 20,000 for their marketing activation for the show. So 20,000 drinks individuals got a suite on the front of their invitation with the phrase "suck it and see," and people had to guess
Fantastic.
Which cocktail they'd got.
Oh, great. Yeah.
So that gave us a huge exposure into sort of B2B work, essentially. So we started working with a lot of alcohol brands through that.
And just one thing's leading to another, I guess.
Yeah, and then we've never done any sort of paid marketing outside of sort of the odd Facebook ad, because for us it's getting in front of the people who are most likely to buy our product, and we didn't know who those people would be until we started selling, so we couldn't sit there and go, you know, we've got a demographic of 25 to 35-year-old women. We didn't know what our demographic was yet. So
well, you can't that's the problem when you've got
when
completely
it's so
new.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. You can't go and get, you know, popcorn research or cold pressed juice research. It isn't nothing.
It's not relevant.
Well, there's no product on the market that is an experience driven edible product, really. Mm. You could say that cakes provide a situation for an experience, but there's nothing that sort of instigates a moment of experience. Mm. So for us it was partnering with a lot of theatre shows, events like Cirque du Soleil, venues like the Roundhouse, and selling in places where we thought our consumer would be an experience engager, and positioning it in the right places
is key
through there. Mm. And to sell it in a way that wasn't static, it wasn't sitting on a shelf. We have people with roaming trays around their neck who go up in character to people to explain what the product is, and we sold a lot of volume through doing that.
Yeah. It's a really fun way to do it. And so much better than sitting in an office going, right, so what is our marketing strategy going to be? And, you know, drawing up a spreadsheet and stuff like that. You know, just get out there and get it into the hands of the people, see what the response is, and, you know, and then go from there. Brilliant.
I think that's right. If it's very difficult to explain, it needs to be a verbal sell, because just leaving it on the shelf, if you just got that into Waitrose, for example, I don't think you'd sell it, because it was brand new, because people wouldn't know what it was. And I think in the first instance for you, it's really important to explain what it was.
And now 2 years down the line, we're relaunching our packaging. We've learnt sort of what the call to actions need to be on the packaging to make it feel like a person standing behind it, essentially. But also, we're talking to a retail brand about creating a whole point of sale that is all about experiences in its essence, so that you don't need to pay staff to stand every time near your product explaining it. It will speak for itself because we're going to have a multi-sensorial shelf.
Yeah.
You know, a shelf that pumps out a smell that smells like the cocktails. Mm. You know, like Subway. Classic Subway marketing inspiration.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. We were talking a few weeks ago, Guy, about there's so many Me Too products at the moment. We're quite concerned about the fact that people aren't making money because there's so
many. Because there's so much of the same thing in a slightly different way.
I mean, how many gin brands, you know, can you get?
Well, it's really funny, I love gin, but, you know, I tend to go for the same one over and over again, unless some delightful person comes for a dinner party and brings me a completely different bottle of gin.
That you're going to try,
which hasn't happened yet.
And I think the thing is, you're marketing so successful because this is truly different, whereas so many products we're seeing aren't truly different, they're a bit different.
But it seems like a combination of different product, but also really innovative marketing. Mm. You know, you could have something like this and just hit and hope with putting it on the shelf, and that just wouldn't work. So it's a combination of two things here that are playing really well together, it seems. Mm.
Can I just quickly, we're going to have a little break and then we're going to talk to Ollie, but can I just ask about your background? You're quite musical, aren't you? I bet you never thought when you know, a teenager thinking, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to make jellies for the rest of my life.
You'd be surprised. I was there as a three-year-old, you know, swindling the bottle of gin. And I am musical. I studied music and I was a jazz singer in a hotel for a couple of years when I was a teenager. And when I was at uni, I ran a series of jazz events and ended up managing a jazz festival. But it kind of, people always go, oh, this is so different. And
It's still marketing, isn't it?
Well, it's about, the reason why I loved music and specifically jazz so much was because when you go to a jazz club, there's this heat to the room. There's this intensity to how people interact and what the music's doing. And that same feeling, that it's all about passion and it's all about that sort of buzz, that vibration that you can create in an experience. And we have made the business grow in a direction in which we're still creating those moments. We've got a pop-up just off Carnaby Street at the moment that's a cocktail bar downstairs. And people come downstairs and it's £12 for your ticket and you get a drink included, and the cocktails have been designed with a garnish bar so that you can create your own garnishes for your cocktail. That's all around multi-sensorial consumption. So we've got gin oils and we've got bergamot perfume and we've got violet lollipops, and then there's an inhalable cocktail that gets produced every 25 minutes that you go over and you breathe it in, and we've got a molecularly deconstructed gin and tonic that's made with macerated botanicals, you know. So you come and you have this whole hour and a half of just complete childlike excitement and then you leave. And that
you're slightly a little bit unsteadily, perhaps.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean,
you're a little bit Willy Wonka, aren't you, Melanie?
Well, yeah. Yeah.
Like experimenting.
We like that fun. It's, you know, we're trying to move it away from being, when people talk about like molecular gastronomy, and it can be quite pretentious and it can, you know, become quite disenchanting for most people. And what we're trying to do is actually say, having fun with something different doesn't have to be elitist. It's actually very mainstream. And
and just keep trying different things. There's no reason. And if they don't work, just stop that. And try
exactly.
Okay, well, that's amazing. I need a little break, a little bit of water.
Did you have a small lie down, Sue?
After that, and I might have a little lie down. We're just going to... I went to an innovation conference a couple of weeks ago, and I was talking to Hendrik van Say, who's working... He works in the innovation unit at Heineken. So we're going to hear from Hendrik van Say now. Hendrik's been responsible, I think you've been responsible, for part of the team developing a new Heineken product that you've just launched this week. Is that right? Just this week?
Yeah, we did launch a new product last week. It's a new zero alcohol Heineken beer. I'm sorry, but I have to disappoint you. I wasn't responsible for that at all. But I was in a tasting session, which I must say was quite surprising to me. It's the first 0% alcohol beer that I've tasted that I thought, after one bottle, I'll have another one.
So it must be good then. It must be good, because all the ones I've tasted taste like washing up liquid. So you're pretty impressed by this, are you?
Yeah, I am, and I'm quite hopeful for the results of this in the markets. So yeah, I am, truly am.
So where is it available? Is it available in all the normal places where Heineken's available, you know, supermarkets and pubs, or how are you marketing it in the first instance?
Yeah, I'm not aware of the exact launch sequence for this product, but it's meant to be quite big. I mean, if we bring something to the market with Heineken, it's global, yes.
You've got to go for it. So tell me some of the problems that you encountered in trying to take alcohol out of beer. I mean, it's quite a difficult thing to do, and I don't think anybody's really, really cracked it yet, so I can't wait to taste yours. So tell me some of the problems that you overcame.
Yeah, it's difficult to have the quality from a 0% alcohol beer. We just didn't think that the standard of the technology was mature enough yet, until recently, for bringing a zero alcohol percent beer to the market under the Heineken quality standards. So yeah, obviously now we think we have achieved that, and like I said, we're quite hopeful of the results.
So what's the basis of it? Is it hops? Is it your normal stuff? And then you've tried to look at how you take the alcohol out. Is it sort of very representative of your normal product?
Yeah, well, it's as far as I know of that content, it's a regular process of brewing a beer, completely natural. And we do have a technology now that allows us to take out the alcohol and make sure that we achieve a taste, a quality that's up to our standards.
And how are you going to market it? Because obviously you're going to have to invest a lot of money, which you normally do with new products. But who do you think you're going to market this at? Is there anybody in particular that you've been sort of profiling as a company?
To be honest, I wouldn't exactly know. I mean, Heineken beer is for mass markets, so that's...
It's a general market.
It's general market, so we are, you know, looking for a taste that appeals to the general market.
And there is a real thrust you're finding. I mean, you've been telling me it's a sort of double-digit growth thing about people trying to look for alternatives with no alcohol. Because when I'm the designated driver, I'm really struggling. I can't drink fruit juice all night. I water doesn't do it for me, and I really struggle to find a grown-up drink. It's going to be a big area, isn't it? And it is a big area, having non-alcohol or very low alcoholic, in inverted commas, drinks.
I think so, yes. Personally, I think this is a good alternative if you are in a pub and you have to drive home for drinking a beverage that is non-alcohol, but still gives you a possibility to drink something that's completely natural and also is non-sugar. So
that's right, it's low sugar as well. I forgot about that.
Yeah, so it's an alternative for your other beverages that you might want to choose. But if you like a beer and you don't want to have too much and drink responsible, this is a very good option.
The only problem I've got, Hendrik, is we're surrounded by all these innovators today. So we've got people from Sainsbury's and PepsiCo and United Biscuits and people like that. And you've arrived to tell everybody about your non-alcoholic beer, and you haven't brought any with you. You haven't brought any samples for us.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. I was flying this morning, and this was kind of difficult to bring that in my backpack.
Yeah, so I'm going to get your number and ask you to send me some samples. So when we're next on the Food Talk show, we can have a little taste and then say then. Thank you very much, Hendrik.
Excellent, good idea. Let's have a beer.
That sounds good. Yeah. Bye now. That was all fascinating stuff. Right, so we're back in the studio. I've sobered up a bit. I've had a little lie down.
It's been all about booze so far, hasn't it? I think we're going to change that.
It's all about booze, yes. I've got some water in front of me, and it was great speaking to Melanie and her Smith and Sinclair jellies. But we're now going to speak to Ollie Lloyd of Great British Chefs. Before we go through your amazing research, which I can't wait to talk about, can you just tell me what Great British Chefs is, please?
Yeah, so we set up Great British Chefs about 7 years ago to really inspire foodies. So we believe that when you look around the web, there are lots of recipes. I mean, there are more recipes than anyone will ever need. But there was a lack of what we call really inspiring recipes. And so we've worked with over 100 of Britain's greatest chefs and now 40 of Italy's greatest chefs to commission bespoke content to create recipes that people can cook at home, inspired by the Marcus Warings, Nathan Outlaws, Tom Aitkins of this world. And we've got about 3,500 recipes, about 1 million followers on social media, and about 1.5 million visits to the website a month.
And
that's slightly showy-offy, that, isn't it, Ollie?
Oh, but he says it in such a kind of calm way.
It's not showy-offy when
that's
we compare ourselves to...
Ollie was a joke.
To Jamie and those guys. So we are, you know, we're about the same size as Delicious Magazine, but, you know, BBC Good Food is 10 times our size. So
yours looks gorgeous, though.
It is really, really nice.
Mm, it does look great.
Thank you. Mm. Thank
clean
you.
And minimal, just like the best restaurants as well. Let the food speak for itself.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got this amazing audience. And I guess if you've got that great audience, it does allow you to really plug into them, get some research, get some feedback.
I think what's lovely about our audience is that every time we conduct any research, we're really proud, as it sounds condescending. We're just like, oh my word, you guys are amazing, because they're all pickling at home and they're all making their own chutneys and they've all given things a whirl and, you know, they've cooked kangaroo and they've tried alligator. And I mean, they're just sort of, they're enjoying life. And I think the thing that differentiates our audience from the average foodie audience or food loving audiences is they do see the world through the lens of food. So it drives where they go to buy their food, what butcher they go to, what fishmonger they go to, where they go on holiday, what they talk about. I mean, it's a major topic of conversation. It's what they invest money in, whether it's equipment, whether it's ingredients.
It's a major thread through their life.
It is.
Yeah.
So in essence, then, you've got this audience who are, I suppose, are self-selecting. You know, they would describe themselves as foodies, although I'm not too keen on the term, but I don't know what else you would use.
And that's, 87% of our audience describe themselves as foodies. Mm. But the interesting thing is, if you look at the other 13%, they exhibit exactly the same characteristics as the people who call themselves foodies. It's a term that some people like and some people don't like.
So they've got the same behaviours and the same attitudes.
Absolutely.
We just haven't got a decent label for it yet. But
correct. And yeah. I think one of the reasons we did this piece of research was that we felt that people often think of foodies as being something that's, you know, all molecular and about banging on about expensive Michelin restaurants and stuff. And that's not what foodies are about. Foodies are, you know, they're all over the country. These are people who live their life through the lens of food and they spend money on it. And they, you know, a lot of the stuff that you cover on this show, you know, they're interested in finding artisanal producers. They want to know what the story of things and they want to know what's in things. And they're happy to make things from scratch.
Mm. So you did this survey in January and February this year. And essentially you had quite a lot of people respond, 5,000 odd?
Yeah,
right?
So we have...
So it's a pretty decent bit of research.
Good sample size.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose we went up to that level because, A, we get it, when we put these surveys out there, we will get 1,000 responses in a couple of days. And we like to then be able to play with the data. So we're starting to do stuff, which we're continuing to release, on how you can take an audience that, let's say, has a sous vide, I know one of your pet hates, and then saying, what else do they have? So you can start to see correlations between, say, ice cream makers and bread makers. You can start to see correlations between pestle and mortars and pickling. So you start to see the correlations. And what we're interested in is starting to form those archetypes, because our business model ultimately is about helping brands reach this premium audience. Data and insight is central to what we do.
So you would describe yourself as a foodie, wouldn't you, Guy?
I would definitely have
those attitudes and behaviours. It sort of drives my life a bit, I think.
Yeah, and it's central to almost everything I do and talk about and think. And, you know, if I'm not working, I'm eating or drinking. Usually both at the same time.
Or thinking about it.
Yeah. Yes. Wake up in the morning, the first thing is, right, so what are we having for dinner tonight?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I don't get as much time to commit to it as I would like these days. You know, I'm a glutton for convenience. But, you know, having quality food is hugely important.
It's a key thing for me travelling as well. I travel a lot around the UK for work, but also when I go on holiday, I specifically choose somewhere because it's got to be great food, because otherwise it's not a good holiday.
That's
for
the
me.
Only reason I go on holiday, to be honest.
Is that what you find with these foodies?
Yeah, I mean, when they look at where to go on holiday, you know, weather. I mean, we live in the UK, so weather is a fundamental driver of where they go on holiday. But the food and the quality of local restaurants is a major driver. And in fact, when you ask them the question, where do they get inspiration? A lot of the inspiration comes from things they've eaten in restaurants, either at home or abroad.
Oh.
So you go somewhere, you try a particular pasta dish, you try a method of cooking a fish, and you say to someone, which we all do, how did you do that? Mm. And I suppose, you know, if you look at the British foodie store cupboard, there are ingredients in there that things like harissa and anchovies and capers and stuff that just were not there 15 years ago.
Definitely
and
not.
It's changed.
Yeah, you should be brought up in the 60s if you think it's moved that far. Melanie, you don't describe yourself as a cook, are you? You're not a cook. But
not
are you
cook.
A foodie? Do you like good
Love
food?
Love eating. And I spend, you know, I always say that when I go on holiday, I'll spend sort of, I'll wake up and from like 9 to 12, I'll look at every restaurant menu in the area to select where I'll have lunch and dinner that day. That's like my favourite thing to do. Fantastic. Menu
that,
hunting.
That doesn't sound extraordinary to me. It sounds perfectly normal.
Yeah,
I think so. Yeah, you're in good company.
Absolutely. Right, can I talk a little bit about this research? And just for anybody that's listening, we will make sure there's a link to this research, because if you are in the food business and your target market is foodies, you need to read this, because it should be shaping how you're doing your marketing and how you're trying to work out how foodies are thinking, because this is how they're thinking and this is what they're looking at, isn't it?
I think that's true. I mean, my background is marketing. I did 10 years of marketing at Unilever on really glamorous brands like Cif and Persil and stuff.
You lucky boy.
I know. It's a good grounding there. And the thing is, for me, is that I think often a lot of marketeers fail to understand that they need, you know, if they're selling a premium product, they need to address this audience properly. And if it's not about the lowest common denominator. And I think too often you see premium food brands that have language that is just, it's not engaging to foodies.
Yeah.
And I think that's a real problem. And I think they do things process-wise, they do things, you know, in terms of their sort of ethics and all stuff, which does not engage their audience. And I think that's why, you know, they will often turn people off.
And like you, I've been 30 years in marketing, and if you don't understand your audience, you won't sell a thing, trust me. So,
correct.
So let's have a look at, we've got a section here called The Store Cupboard. Now, top foodie staples. So this is what foodies say that they have in their store cupboard. I'm going to test you on this, Guy.
I didn't know there was going to be a test today.
Yes. Do you have soy sauce in your cupboard?
I do have soy sauce.
Balsamic vinegar?
Yes, about 16 different varieties.
Dear me. risotto rice?
Yes. Arborio?
Me too. Coconut milk?
Just ran out yesterday. Have some coconut cream, though.
Ah, sesame oil?
Maybe not.
Olives?
Yes.
Fish sauce?
Yes.
Capers?
No, not a huge fan of capers.
I do. You've got to have capers when you're having white fish and a white sauce. You have to have capers. Ollie's agreeing with me there. Rice noodles? Making the odd ramen for yourself, yeah. Anchovies?
No, I don't really like the anchovies. Too salty, too fishy.
No. That's not what it's about. What you use anchovies for is if you're roasting a leg of lamb, you stuff,
Yeah, and they just kind of,
in,
I know that they melt away and
then you get
that
lovely
seasoning.
Saltiness, which you can't by just putting salt on the top. Ollie, exactly, do you agree with that?
Exactly, yes, right.
Okay, I need to go back to school.
You do. So I have all of those in my store cupboard. What I don't have is, you've got Middle Eastern ingredients in here. Is that a bit of a trend you're finding, Ollie?
I definitely think it's one of the trends. I mean, I think people are trying different cuisines. There are restaurants on the high street that now, you know, will celebrate these kinds of ingredients. And I think people are discovering different ingredients. And so they are picking up the preserved lemons and the harissas of this world to sort of spice things up, so to speak.
Mm. And there are some very good preserved lemons out there, aren't there?
So you see, I don't think so. I don't think... I have a strange thing where my mother makes me preserved lemons. I'm not sure why. She brings them to me every sort of month and a half, and I, in exchange, do confit garlic. So I give her confit garlic. So there's a little pot that travels back between the two of us.
And nothing can compare to that.
And for me, doing it from scratch just is a different league.
I can see that. And going global, people have got things like Tabasco, harissa, as you said, jalapenos. I don't know what these
sriracha
are.
Sriracha
and gujang.
I don't have that at all.
I don't have those.
What are they?
Sriracha is just a very, very spicy sauce. And it's the thing that's funny about all these things is that, you know, when you go to a lot of farmers market stuff, you'll often see people selling new pickles, selling new spices. And I think people just pick these things up and they're like, what's that? And you go into a Vietnamese restaurant, they've got on the table. And I think that's what kind of happens in terms of, you know, the ingredients that people are discovering.
Ah, that sriracha. It's a sriracha chili, isn't it? Is it Korean style or Vietnamese style? Yeah, I do have some of that. I just didn't know what it was.
Oh, there you go. Didn't have a name for it.
So a lot of these things that we're looking at here as we go through this wonderful paper, there's some really exotic and adventurous and interesting things. And it kind of leads me to think, is this because your audience is very kind of sophisticated in their palates and their travels and stuff like that? Is there any interesting trends in terms of the types of people? Do you have demographic data on this as well?
So we have demographic data in terms of age and in terms of gender and regionality. One of the things that someone said to me the other day is it would be interesting to know actually the sort of the ethnicity of our audience in terms of how many people are, you know, purely British or English or Scottish or Welsh. And actually, I think that might be one of the things that's within this, which is these are people who are...
As opposed to second generation, third generation from
exactly.
From
somewhere. So you're getting that sort of... That flavor. My wife's Sri Lankan, we therefore have all sorts of crazy stuff in our house. And I think that sort of, you know, you go back to some of those heritage cuisines. And I just think that, you know, the cuisine of this country has fundamentally changed.
Oh,
it's not British and French.
Oh, this country is amazing. Yeah. I just think we're so lucky to be here.
Yeah, there's something for everyone, really, isn't there? Mm. I mean, whether you are, you know, you're in your kind of small area where you live with the same kinds of people or whatever, they bring that kind of cultural diversity to everybody, and everybody has the opportunity to get involved and enjoy.
I'm going to talk now about some more of this research. So one of the things you looked at is what sort of meats and fish are these people eating? You know, what is their favourite? And again, I stress we're talking about foodies, we're not talking about the population as a whole. So top meat and poultry. And what you've done with your research is you said, this is what they eat regularly, this is what they eat occasionally, this is what they've eaten once, and this is what they've never eaten. So the top meat and poultry, probably not a surprise, chicken. Absolutely. And people are just eating it regularly, aren't they?
Mm.
And then beef next, pork, lamb. Not too much difference between beef, pork and lamb.
No.
But chicken's the number one. Probably because of convenience for cooking, I'm guessing.
I think so. It's an easy dish. And I think people have got a lot of simple chicken dishes that are in their repertoire. And I think when you understand the sheer breadth of what's in foodie store cupboards, you know, you were talking about convenience earlier. And I think that actually for a foodie, convenience is walking into their store cupboard, pulling out four ingredients and throwing something together. Yeah. And that might be a simple chicken dish with tomatoes and olives and capers and, you know, some fresh herbs and rice. Or it might be, you know, a pasta dish. I think the point for me is that when you've got these ingredients at your fingertips, you can just play.
Mm. Yeah.
Very versatile.
And the sort of second tier meats you've got here, poussin, veal, mutton, guinea fowl, hogget, quail, goat, goose, suckling pig. Interestingly here with lamb, mutton and hogget are amazing. So hogget is a lamb that's less than 18 months old, have I got that right? And mutton's older.
Yeah.
I always had the impression that mutton's like old and therefore it's horrible. Realise, worn out, but actually it tastes
it's
fabulous.
Got just a much deeper flavour, isn't it?
It's absolutely gorgeous, but it's very difficult to get hold of.
It is, but well, less so when you go to good butchers. And I think what's happening with this audience is that they have, you know, whether it's post-Horsegate, who knows, but they have definitely turned back to butchers and fishmongers.
Mm.
Because truth be told, while the supermarkets do a good job of having the core proteins, they're not going to have this kind of stuff. And if you want specific cuts, you want specific ingredients, you have to go to quality specialist retailers.
And that's how quality specialist retailers need to survive, because if you just replicate the supermarket, nobody's going to come to you because you can't compete on price. So you've got to offer what the supermarkets can't. Mm.
Correct. And that's where I think actually, you know, there is a role for the butchers and the fishmongers to be encouraging people to eat beyond the sort of the top fours of protein.
Exactly. Mm. And even if they do, then eating nose to tail and eating the whole thing, including the offal and all the other bits and pieces. I know that's something that we were looking at before.
We're going to talk about offal in a minute, aren't we? Can I talk about fish first?
See, I think venison's very interesting as well, which is one of those things that actually in this country is very popular.
It's very traditional meat, though.
Yeah.
It's got a huge history, and pheasant too, actually. Yeah. So yes, venison's actually much more popular than I thought.
Yeah, it is popular. And I think, you know, venison burgers, for example, like people are producing this kind of stuff. It's a very lean meat. It's not, you know, relatively speaking, that expensive. And I think people do cook with it a lot. And it's one of those sort of classics, particularly. And again, I think there's often a danger in food conversations. We talk about London. I think you need to remember that when you're out, you know, way outside of London, things like venison are just, you know, it's kind of what's around.
Yeah.
And actually lots of people eat it. And so
I tell you what, I was fascinated by your research. Hare is a very, very traditional English food. And it's not unloved so much as I'm not sure people know about it.
Yeah,
well, we've got 82% here that have never had it.
82% have never, ever had hare.
Of foodies as well.
Of foodies as well, yeah. And a gorgeous, gorgeous meat, game. Not being utilised at all. Whereas, you know, partridge is way, way above something like hare. So interesting, might have to have a little campaign to bring back hare.
I think one of the things for me that's really interesting about this research is you do understand some of those neglected species sections where you sort of go, you know, that's really interesting. And part of it is, you know, no one is promoting hare in this country. No. People are promoting, you know, beef, lamb and stuff, but no one's promoting hare. I mean, you know, but rabbit still performs quite well. I think it's rare you go into a butcher and they say, oh, hare's on special.
I don't think I've even seen it, actually.
I've seen it at a farmer's market a couple of times.
Yeah,
it's
that's
very
about
rare.
It, farmer's
it's very
market.
Rare.
Let's talk about fish then, my favourite. Salmon absolutely comes out top, but I would say no surprise. I'm quite disappointed to see cod at the a very close second, given some of the sustainability issues. And I do think that there's a real thing about people not understanding the different types of fish, and also the supermarkets only offering a tiny range.
It's very limited selection.
Tiny range. Yeah. Awful range, really. And please bring back more fishmongers. I am so blessed where I am because we have an amazing fishmongers, and I just go in there and look at what looks amazing and then choose that. And you know, you're looking at bream, herring, white bait, right down the end, hardly being used at all. Is that about availability or actual just not understanding how to cook it or use it?
I think it's about availability, and I don't think anyone's, you know, championing this stuff enough. And interesting, we get a lot of traffic, so if you search for monkfish recipes, you know, those kinds of search terms, we get loads of traffic from that kind of stuff. And actually, I think foodies are embracing things like the monkfishes and the sea basses. But I find mackerel the most depressing one, which, you know, I think is one of my favourite fish.
And mine.
And it's cheap. And there are so many things you can do with it. Chefs love it. It pairs well, amazing, with all sorts of other big flavours. It's really healthy. And
I mean, what other fish could you have with gooseberry, for example? And yet they go amazingly
well. Or rhubarb.
Or rhubarb, yeah. Absolutely. Not rhubarb jellies, though, man.
I'm not sure the fish would go with that.
No. Herring for me as well. Why are people eating sardines when actually herrings are almost exactly the same, but they're meatier and fleshier and easier?
But I don't see them. You know, even in the good fishmongers, I don't think I see herring as often as I see sardines.
Mm.
I did try and buy sardines on Valentine's Day, and I was told by my fishmonger they were not a Valentine fish.
Fantastic.
Yes, you're a real smoothie, aren't you? I bet your Sri Lankan wife loved that. Seafood, prawns, top as well, not a surprise. Mussels, scallops, shrimps, all what you expect. Cockles, again, very, very traditional English thing, which is not being consumed much. I think it's very interesting to see. I've spoken to a lot of chefs and a lot of fishmongers about cuttlefish and razor clams. It's a very, very Spanish and Portuguese thing. It has a particular texture. But cuttlefish is used all the time in Spain and Portugal, but just not over here.
Yeah, Nathan Outlaw's actually in his second fish cookbook has got a fabulous cuttlefish curry that he does. And it's one of those really can take it.
Yeah.
And I think it's great. It's one of our team is Catalan. And, you know, she will say that it's, you know, she wants to cook cuttlefish at Christmas and couldn't find it anywhere. It is still difficult to find. And it's unloved, but I think it's coming back.
If you talk to fishermen in this country, particularly on Brixham and stuff like that, they will catch shed loads of cuttlefish and all they do is export it abroad. Yeah. Nobody wants it here, which is incredible, actually.
Yeah, it's very sad. I mean, I think it is a great thing to cook.
Now, my favourite thing, I'd like to talk testicles, if that's okay with you, Ollie. And the reason why I want to talk testicles is we've got offal here. And in your research, you've got a map of the UK. And in the south of Scotland, testicles is the top offal. What can you say about that?
Yeah, so we wanted to ask about offal because I think it's one of those things that has become quite popular in the restaurant world, and people are interested in the sort of, you know, the oxtails and the cheeks and stuff. And we just want to understand how deeply this stuff is being cooked. And what we've tried to do is show on a map of Britain where basically certain offal are over-indexing.
You are giggling while you're saying this.
It's kind of hilarious. I mean, it was kind of hilarious when we did the piece of research because we're like, really? You know, the Welsh, they love
heart. My favourite sentence in your research here is it says, men being more offal orientated than women. That's one of my favourite sentences of all time. Men are more offal orientated than women.
I'd say I'm not a huge fan. It doesn't really do it for me.
Offal, I love offal.
Some of the bits and pieces. Yeah, bone marrow, cheeks, oxtail. Yes, I guess it's the kind of the meatier end of the spectrum. But I've always just had an issue with some of the texture of it. I don't know.
Funny about the texture too. I'm just the texture of offal.
I mean, the first time I ate tripe, I swore I'd never eat it again. And then I remember eating it beautifully cooked and it was sublime. And I think there's no question, you need technique.
It is preparing technique. And for anybody who doesn't know about tripe is the stomach lining of either the first or second stomach of a cow. If that doesn't put you off, I don't know what will. But it is about how you cook it, I think.
Yeah.
I just want to talk about sweetbreads because so many people say, oh, I'm not going to order sweetbreads because it is testicles, and that is just rubbish. So sweetbreads isn't testicles at all, is it? Sweetbreads is glands, and it's normally the thymus, which is throat or the gullet or the neck, or in the pancreas, which is heart, stomach, belly, and it's mostly calf and lamb. So if you've never had sweetbreads, try them. They are not testicles, so don't worry about it. And they do taste sweet. They are gorgeous, aren't they?
And they're not difficult to cook.
No, I mean, not at all.
And I have to say, this is one of those stats. There are lots of stats in this research that surprised us. But the idea that, you know, 18% of foodies have cooked sweetbreads, You know, it's pretty impressive. Yeah. And one of the things that we quite like about this research is it definitely, you know, people we know who completed the research, they said, you know, it made me feel like I needed to step up my game. Yeah. They're like, you know, and I think that's what's funny about it. Is you sort of go, well, I haven't cooked sweetbreads. Why haven't I cooked sweetbreads?
Yeah, so if you've never cooked them, what you do is basically you soak them in salt water. And then normally poach them in milk, which quite often you might do with calves liver, for example. And then you remove the sort of, there's an outer membrane, isn't there? You just take that off. That's not really not difficult. And then you just dry them and fry them. I mean, it's not hard at all. But I think people just don't know how to do that. Testicles, for anybody who wants to try them, don't even know where you can get them from. But I've used to them being called fries. So lamb fries.
Yeah.
Is that tends to be the name for it? Is that
I think that's correct.
Yeah. You got that right.
I have to. I am not in the 1.8% or whatever it is of people who have cooked testicles. So again, this is where there's an opportunity.
Just to let you know, you do have to skin them if you ever do try it, Ollie. Just let you know that.
Thank you.
The reason why I know about this stuff is because I went to Rome, and Rome is renowned for its or was renowned for its abattoirs, and also they are absolutely renowned for offal cooking. It probably is the key place. So if you go to one of these amazing places in Rome that tourists just do not go to, and nobody speaks English, you will get what they call a plate of entrails. And I have tried all these things, and they just know how to cook them. Mm. And they are absolutely delicious.
But it's interesting because when we think about Italian food, we often ghettoize it in sort of pasta and risotto. And actually, you know, one of the things we've been very struck by is Italy is experiencing a food revolution at the moment, and they're cooking a way broader spectrum than I think we've ever known, and are doing much more interesting things.
And offal was the poor man's stuff. You know, you know, rich people don't take all the choice cuts because they have the money to buy it, and you know what gets left, and they call it the fifth quarter, I think, in Italy a lot. It's you know, the other stuff, but of course it's incredibly cheap, and got loads of vitamins and minerals in it. And just going through this research, marrow particularly. In Mary, London, not
yeah,
surprised
it's
at that.
It's not a surprise. No, I wasn't hugely surprised by that. It's
and heart in Wales. Don't know if you ever cooked heart. Have you?
I have.
It's good
heart.
if you stuff it again. Yep, exactly. Amazing.
I was going to say if you stop it first.
Stuff it. Sorry, I meant stuff it. But if you stuff it with some really nice stuffing, actually, it's a delicious thing.
I think for foodies as well, and you know, we were struck by the fact that you know a crazy number of people have cooked. You know, things like ostrich, is that actually, on one level, foodies are interested in trying new things and cooking new things because it's just a bit more interesting than a roast chicken.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is their thing, right? This is their hobby. So if you look at an adrenaline junkie, they're going to look to jump off the biggest mountain, the highest bridge, the whatever, and they, you know, keep trying to step it up. And foodies must be the same. Like, oh, I'm a bit bored of chicken. Let's see what we can do.
I know.
Let's have some testicles.
I live in Northumberland. Let's have blood. Which is their favourite. Mm. Blood what? Blood sausage? Perhaps. I don't know. Who knows?
It's just an ingredient we asked
for. Buy some blood.
I mean, I think, you know, but again, I think it's interesting that, you know, there's been a lot of narrative in the press about the fact that Brits can only cook seven dishes and we always cook the seven things and it's all salmon and chicken and stuff. Mm. But the reality is there is an enormous cohort of foodies, and they estimate it's about 8 million people in the UK, who are genuinely cooking creatively. And we were, you know, we were very impressed. You know, they cook over 90 dishes. Yeah. And, you know, we gave them a list of 200 dishes and say, you know, which of these do you cook?
Melanie doesn't cook any, by the way, but yes.
But you probably eat at least 90.
Yes. I make a really good vegetarian lasagna.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Mm. But lasagna's the top.
Yeah.
It's the top thing that people cook, isn't it?
Yeah.
Basic.
Mm. Can I talk about pies?
Yes.
Love a good pie, but homemade. No, I haven't really found any pies that you can buy that I really like, but foodies' favourite pies? Guesses here, Guy?
Well, I'm looking at the
stats. Oh, you've got it in front of you, Beef and ale pie is a foodie's favourite pie, but chicken pie, fish pie, very, very, very similar, actually, aren't they?
Sausage roll as well. Is that a pie?
It was pastry.
Pastry-based things.
Pastry.
And I think one of the things that's interesting about pastry is that once you've cracked it and you understand how to make it or you're buying a pre-made
pastry.
It's really simple. I mean, you know, my go-to dinner party dessert is a tarte tatin because in the end it is so easy.
Oh, so good.
And so good. Mm. And actually, you know, I think it's the same with, you know, doing a big sausage roll. Again, if you know what you're doing, it doesn't take very long.
No,
and this is, if you can cook, this is true convenience food.
Yeah.
Can we talk about appliances and kits?
Yeah.
You've got a huge list there of what our foodies buy. And again, if you're in the food sector, it's probably important to know what they have around so that you're shaping what you do for what's in their cupboards. Anything that really jumps out for you there, Ollie?
I think the thing that's really struck us is that over the years, foodies have, you know, really embraced, you know, the technology of the kitchen. And I think people have gone beyond the sort of basic stuff. That's not to say they don't have pestle and mortars in the home. They absolutely do. But they have got a lot of kit. You know, the average number of appliances is 14. And, you know, there are definitely what we've identified as different segments. So, you know, 50% of people own an ice cream maker, also own a bread maker. So there are people who sort of go, okay, well, I understand this methodology of cooking. So it's a specialist piece of kit to do a particular thing. And then they embrace that. But it's also interesting because lots of this kit does the same thing. So, you know, if you want to make a meringue, you feel like foodies have got two or three different ways of doing it. And so you see huge overlap where they've got different bits of kit that actually allow them to do the same things.
Slow cookers right up the top there. Now, yeah. I would never have believed that.
I mean, it's interesting. We've seen some national research as well on this, and foodies over-index on slow cookers. And I think it's that convenience thing, which is, you know, if you have a slow cooker, you know, you pan fry a bit of stuff, you throw it in there and you walk out the door. You come home and there's your dinner.
I suppose if you're a foodie and like me, I won't buy convenience food and I won't buy processed food, apart from the odd thing like tin baked beans, but very, very rarely, and cook from scratch. If you're determined to cook from scratch and you leave a very, very busy life, a slow cooker is your answer, isn't it?
It is. I think modern ovens nowadays do allow you to do the same thing in some ways with all the timer functionality, where you can set it to turn off.
I can't understand the timer on mine.
No, mine's just a clock, quite frankly.
Yeah, I don't understand that at all.
I've cracked that. I haven't cracked the television, but I've worked out the way that you can turn the oven on.
There's one way to crack a television. Yeah. Get an 11-year-old, they'll tell you.
Yeah, you're probably right. My 4-year-old hasn't worked it out yet.
No, they will soon, don't worry. So slow cookers. Yes, there. So slow cookers. Anything else that sticks out for you? I mean, sous vide machines.
Yeah, so sous vides are there, and I think there's so 8% of foodies have a sous vide, and that's about 300,000 people in the UK.
Well, it's quite a lot of people. It's
quite expensive. They're quite expensive.
Well, interestingly, you can buy a stick, which is the basic level, which does the heating element, and stick it on the side of a Perspex box. Basically, that's what I have. And you know, the great thing about it is that we were discussing it earlier. You can poach eggs in 15 minutes and, you know, you crack open the eggs and there are poached eggs for your breakfast of 10 or whatever it is. So on big entertaining occasions, it does allow you to do things that you wouldn't do otherwise.
Yeah, you can prep stuff in advance as well, I guess.
And also, I think for barbecues and stuff, it does allow you to really kind of, you know, make sure your meat is properly cooked before you kind of finish it.
I mean, I can understand it for chicken. I get really angry when I go to a restaurant and they say, oh, yeah, we've got this steak. It's been sous vide first. Well, you know, sirloin, for goodness sake. I mean, I just don't understand it. And then they'll flash fry it on the outside or whatever. And I was thinking, if you're a really good chef and you really understand about steak, you do not need to put steak in a sous vide.
Totally correct. And I think and lamb as well, see the same. You know, if you really know what you're doing and you can, you know, but it comes down to this.
Maybe it's a timing and operations thing, though, as well. You know,
I think
you can get them all done in advance.
It's just being trendy and it doesn't work for me. With chicken, it is hard to make chicken really, really juicy. And that's where a sous vide really works, I think.
I'm trusting you haven't tried the 8-hour Heston upside down 100 degrees.
Oh, I hate
roast
Heston.
Chicken. I know you do.
But I don't hate his restaurants because I think he's amazing. But I think that's where Heston works, is in restaurants. Yeah. And it's stunning and it's amazing. And I'm full of admiration. What I object to is taking that on television and then people thinking they have to cook like that and it putting them off. And it just really upsets me.
Totally agree. And I think the thing that we're passionate about from a chef perspective is I do think there are certain techniques and you know, things you need to know about temperatures and ways of cooking things to get the best out of stuff. But I don't think, you know, you don't want to do the kind of, you know, 16-day thing. Although I have to say, a lot of our audience have spent over a day producing a dish. But it's, you know, if you brine a chicken, it changes everything.
It's the Black Forest gatter that took 7 days to make and had 450 ingredients. It's just like, and you needed stuff I've never even seen.
That's why I like things like the pickles that people are doing from scratch, the curing, all that sort of stuff.
That's incredible, isn't it?
But it tastes just so much better. It's back to the lemons.
Well, we're going to have you back on again because there's so much in this research that we need to talk about. We could talk about for at least another 2 hours. So very, very interesting. I don't know if that's helped you, Melanie, because I would guess some of your audience are foodies and it's getting inside their heads and working out what they're interested in, I think, is really important.
And, you know, everything you say about how do you understand a premium audience? You can't take guesses. You've got to think, where are they shopping? What are they buying? What is in their kitchen? And why would they buy us as a gift? And it's hugely been influential to how we remarket the brand, how we're looking digitally, how our new packaging is going to look, and also how people appropriate it. What we realised is there's very few opportunities where there are six people at a dinner party. There's usually more or less. It's usually four or like 8 to 16. Mm. So why have we done a box of six? Mm. Yeah, and the new packaging is going to be optimized so that you don't have to eat them all within the first opening of one bag.
Although I would, obviously.
I mean, people do. But having each pastel individually wrapped, it means that the people with the sous vides who, you know, need to kill 15 minutes before their poached eggs done can slip a pastel quickly.
Mm, that's very good. Well, we're running out of time. So if you want to know about Melanie's amazing, you really should try them. It's smithandsinclair.co.uk. And thank you very much to Ollie Lloyd. And you need to just Google Great British Chefs.
Some great stuff there.
Yeah, really we'll put the research on the website.
Fantastic.
So thank you to everybody.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you
for listening.
Bye now.